Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie here, as always, with John. What is up?
Not a whole lot, man. It's can't believe it's already December. That's crazy.
Yes, I'm trying to do the math in my head without taking my shoes off. This will come out in December. We're recording it before Thanksgiving. Hopefully you all had a great holiday. Hopefully you got to spend time with family. I'm interested, John, in how other people in other countries celebrate, if at all, Thanksgiving. I actually work with several Canadians, and they do have Canadian Thanksgiving, but it's very different.
At the same time as us?
No, it's not. So it's very different. And I know we have lots of international listeners. So please email us, comment. I'd love to know.
Unless you're from England, Joe, talking to you specifically.
Wow. We've been throwing a lot of shots at Joe.
I know. And I think she knows we love her.
I hope so.
We have a lot of listeners in the UK, actually. But this is I feel like this is an American holiday.
Yeah.
Like the 4th of July. And President's Day.
Yeah. A lot of days. But we're happy to be here. This is a case that's, I think, pretty popular in the true crime world. Kind of want to give our spin and take on it. It's one that we covered on A True Crime to Go once. And there's been a couple of instances where we wanted to elaborate. And we are doing that here today with the Jason Landry case. Before we get into it, I got a couple people I want to thank from 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. The name of this person is A Person in a Large World. I'm a 14-year-old and I absolutely love True Crime Cast. I listen on long car rides with my family. My favorite episode so far was the Watts family episode.
Ooh, I remember that one.
That's a tough one to be a favorite, but thank you, Person in a Large World, for listening. Glad your family enjoys what we do. This is from Dame Dana. Says these guys genuinely care and it shows. It makes for amazing listening. So appreciate that. And the title of that one is Patient and Thorough, which are two things that I don't think my family would say I am. So appreciate that greatly.
All right. Yesterday we released a new episode that was an exclusive, only available to our Patreon members. So if you're looking for a Christmas present for yourself, treat yourself, go visit patreon.com. Sign up for as little as $3 a month, and you get access to all of our bonus episodes, which has been around for 7 years.
Yeah, we're almost at 100. Yeah,
so 100 bonus episodes that you've never heard, and you will also get our regular content early and ad-free.
This month's episode, The Murder of Bill McGuire. Very interesting case.
Yeah, we call it the Suitcase Killer case. Go look that one up. It's only available for Patreon members. Yes, we're trying to sell you something. No, I don't think you will regret it. That's the extent of my sales pitch.
Great job, John. I think you did such a great job that I'm going to let you get us rolling today.
Back in 2020, Jason Landry was 21 years old. He was a goofball who always had a big smile on his face. He had older siblings who were very regimented. They were role-oriented and type A, but this was not at all like Jason. He hated planning and following the rules. Jason grew up in the suburbs of Houston, Texas. He was over 6 foot tall. He had olive-complected skin and light brown hair. After high school, he started college at Sam Houston State. Once he left home, he went from a fairly clean-cut kid to letting his inner slacker out. He grew out his hair. He started wearing tie-dyed hoodies and t-shirts. Basically a modern day hippie.
It's wild how higher education lends itself to that type of lifestyle. That's pretty common on most college campuses.
In the beginning of his college career, he, similar to me, did not show very much interest in academics. But by his third year, his grades were improving. He had transferred to Texas State University. His family was excited that Jason may have finally started getting serious about college.
And look, I've worked with college students for years. I have kids that are talking about college, which makes me want to throw up. But I just find it so unfortunate that we expect people to know what they want to do with their lives when they're 18, 19 years old. I think it takes us a little longer for our brains to develop and us to find our interests. And it seems like Jason was starting to reach that point. But as he was getting it all together, like for the rest of us, the COVID-19 pandemic turned our world upside down. Jason was stuck in virtual classes. He was completely isolated, which if you go back to what John said about his personality, was not what he needed. He needed socialization. He needed to be out there. He needed to have a good time. His dad described Jason as a pure extrovert full of pure optimism, which is my favorite type of person and maybe the exact opposite of me. He had been making friends with strangers since he was a toddler, but now, being isolated, he was having a hard time. He started smoking more marijuana. His dad would say that he was stuck in a small apartment in a small room on an empty floor. It was like solitary confinement for him, and I'm not surprised at all that he self-medicated, which I think a lot of people ended up doing during that time. In the days before his disappearance, Jason's record showed that he had been ordering a lot of takeout, getting a lot of Chick-fil-A and Subway, which I think my records would show the same.
Chick-fil-A sounds amazing. He had also started acting strangely in his online accounts. Jason was taking close-up videos of marijuana buds and filming himself talking about getting his life back on the right track. In his Instagram messages, Jason told a friend that his drug use was helping him to see the face of God. Now, that's interesting.
Concerning.
He may have been joking, but other records indicate that Jason may have stopped eating and sleeping just so he could smoke more, which would lead to these delusions. Jason's longtime friend named Jack started to worry about him. He said, quote, "It seemed more and more apparent that our conversations weren't making sense anymore. Jason would talk about the rapture coming, aliens, Jesus, Elon Musk, and all of these things that tie together somehow." Jamie, his conversations sound like conversations that perhaps we've had together.
I was thinking that same thing. John and I have been listening to some kind of out there podcasts, including Blurry Creatures, where a lot of these things do come together in some of their stories. So not completely surprised, and I'll talk about that more in a minute.
Jason was growing more and more interested in mysticism and talked about the movie DMT, The Spiritual Molecule. This documentary features a clinical psychologist who is exploring the link between psychedelic drugs with near death and spiritual experiences. There's a really good podcast on that I'll tell you about off the air. Jason DM'd one friend and said, quote, "Dude, I low key have always wanted to be a monk and reach spiritual enlightenment someday and levitate from meditation or turn into a stone statue and achieve nirvana or something," end quote.
That's a lot of spiritual words there. Yeah, DMT, continuing research is showing that weird things happen when you're on psychedelics. Weird things spiritually, mentally, emotionally. It's a thing that I think more people are experimenting with, which I think back in the 70s they were just doing it for fun. But here there's more of it's more focused by some groups and super interesting. But I've seen a lot of negative feedback from people who have experimented in those ways. Now, despite this behavior that his family considered strange, his family talked to him on the weekend before he went missing. And they said for the most part, he was acting like himself. They weren't overly concerned. On December 13th of 2020, Jason was in his apartment in San Marcos, Texas. He spent about 45 minutes FaceTiming with a friend while he was rolling some joints of marijuana. At some point, he decided that he wanted to drive to his parents' house in Missouri City, Texas for winter break. He packed up a bag of toiletries, grabbed his PlayStation and a laptop, grabbed a handful of joints that he had been rolling, put them in a pill container, and then put everything in a black backpack to go home. He put his Siamese fighting fish, who he called Sparky, into a plastic tumbler he often used as a pet carrier when transporting Sparky. Now, there was a cold front sweeping through the area at this time. I think we all think of Texas as a place that's hot all the time. It's not necessarily the case. I have some friends that live down there and get more snow than we do. But that night, Jason had a t-shirt on, shorts and sandals, and was wearing a pair of SpongeBob socks. He put everything in his Nissan Altima. He pulled up the route on his Waze app, which I use, not a sponsor, but could be, love Waze, and he hit the road at around 10:55 p.m.
The trip was 165 miles and should have taken only a little over 2.5 hours. Jason took Texas Highway 80 into Caldwell County. During the drive, he was talking to his friends. He was talking to an ex-girlfriend on FaceTime and Snapchat. And he told them that he had finished his finals and his last shift at Jimmy John's earlier that week. And by all accounts, he was in good spirits. Around 11:15 p.m., you can see that he is still on Texas Highway 80. He's passing Texas 130 and drives through several small towns like Frentress, Prairie Leah, and Stairtown. At 11:28 p.m., Jason takes a photo on Snapchat in the car and he sends it to his ex-girlfriend. At 11:30 p.m., he arrives in Luling, Texas. When he approaches the intersection of Hackberry Street and 80, he turns off his Waze app and starts using Snapchat. He continues on Hackberry Street, which then changes into Austin Street, goes all the way to Magnolia Street, and that's where his digital footprint stops.
Yeah, and I mean, some people may be thinking, why was he looking up directions home? He knew his way to his house. I do this as well to help me understand, when am I going to get home? Are there any traffic issues I need to go around? So him using the Waze app, I think,
is the
normal.
Speed. Are there cops reported in the area?
Right.
That's
excellent.
Why people use Waze.
Should be a sponsor. So he is in this small area and just kind of goes off the radar digitally. Authorities have spent a lot of time going through this timeline. And they believe instead of turning right on Magnolia, which would have taken him toward his house, he drove straight through the intersection on East Austin Street to Spruce Street, which turns into Salt Flat Road. Now, all this may not make a lot of sense to you. I encourage you to go and look at a map to see that he distinctly went the wrong direction. And this was before he took down the Waze app. At 12:31 in the morning on December 14th, 2020, his Altima was found by a firefighter. The lights were on, the keys were in the ignition, and the front passenger seat door was locked. The firefighter reported this, and the Texas Public Safety sent troops to respond about an hour later. So keep in mind, he was in Luling, Texas. He had left his apartment at 10:55, so he's not even getting close to home anyway. It was around 11:30 when his tracks kind of stopped and we lost track of him. So he's only been on the road for like 40 minutes. And then another hour later is when they find his car. The theory is that Jason crashed into a tree and hit a barbed wire fence after overcorrecting on gravel or spinning out of control. Again, it was cold. We don't think it was frozen, but it was definitely cold. The rear window of the car was broken from probably some type of impact, maybe with the tree that his car was up against. This wasn't the type of accident where he hit a tree head on and would have been in critical condition, but it was obvious that his car had made this impact and he left it there. Again, keys in the ignition, lights on, nowhere to be found.
There was no other evidence to indicate that there was any other car involved. No first responders had entered the vehicle. They would have logs of responding to the scene if there had been. The car was just taken to an impound lot, and the scene appeared pretty unremarkable until the firefighter pointed out that about 900 feet from the car was Jason's backpack. It was sitting on the side of the road. In it was his wallet, his laptop, and his joints. They also found his toiletries and the plastic tumbler with Sparky, who was already dead and was placed on the ground nearby. Then they found Jason's clothes lying in the middle of the road a few more feet away. They weren't in a pile. They were, however, neatly dropped into small piles, like when someone undresses and they're walking towards the shower. You know what I mean?
Yep.
On the road.
I just throw mine, but I get it.
Yeah. On the road was a red t-shirt from a Christian summer camp where he had worked. His wristwatch was placed face up on the shirt. There was a pair of black Nike shorts and then some gray underwear with a small blood stain on the waistband. So it seems like maybe he was injured, you know, from this accident. Near the pair of underwear was some black sandals and two socks. So did Jason leave the scene of the wreck naked and barefoot in the dead of winter? This is very strange behavior, but before this accident, we know he was exhibiting some strange behavior, at least online and when he was back in his college dorm.
And, you know, such an interesting scene. When you think about somebody, let's assume that he did hit his head in some way, and maybe he was out of it. He walks 900 feet, drops his backpack, and then puts his clothes in neat piles on his way to the, like he would on his way to the shower. His watch is laying there face up. Like, everything seems almost too organized to have been done by somebody out of it. Wait, do you have thoughts on that? And I agree that the blood on the waistband may have come from some type of, I don't know, maybe he did hit his head. He had some kind of injury, a piece of glass cut him, something like that.
My first thought was, in his mind, is he doing something that is part of his routine, but he's not where he thinks he is? So, like, in his mind, is he getting into the shower and getting ready to go somewhere, but he's in the middle of the road, and so he's just so disoriented, whether it's from narcotics, hitting his head, a combination of the two.
Yeah.
You know, I just think his mental state is obviously not right.
That's a really good point. I mean, that's something I've done sleepwalking before is...
I'm just now hearing about this.
Yes, I woke up one time in the living room at my parents' home, and I walked into the kitchen thinking it was the bathroom. I'll leave the rest of that story for another time. But that is something that happens, and maybe that was where he was. Regardless, spoiler alert, we still haven't seen Jason. We don't know where he is. We're going to spend the rest of the episode trying to figure out where he may be and what his family did when they found out he was missing. Jason's dad, Kent, was the legal owner of Jason's car, so he got a call at 2 a.m. from the police saying that they had the car, they had impounded it, and he could come pick it up. Now, Kent obviously knows that something's wrong here. The car should not have been abandoned at all. They can't get a hold of Jason, so he takes off to Luling looking for his son. He even packed a blanket and some warm clothes, thinking he may find Jason somewhere out in the cold. He wanted to be prepared for that. He got to the impound lot around 5:30 a.m. and inspected his son's vehicle. The driver's side was unlocked, and Kent found Jason's phone between the driver's seat and the center console. Again, that may have happened on impact. Kent took the phone, and he went to the crash scene to see if he could find anything that authorities had not. It was closer to morning. It may have been a little lighter. Obviously, the middle of the night when authorities found it. He got there around 6 a.m., and he found his son's clothes in the road. He found his backpack that had been taken for evidence. There was no crime scene tape, no detectives, nobody really looking into what may have happened there, and nobody at all looking for Jason. He started wandering the area on foot, he being Kent, filming the crash site, recording what was going on. He also tried to capture the marks in the gravel road that showed where the car had gone off of the road and potentially hit the tree. This area was in the middle of nowhere. It was miles of oil fields covered with hundreds of wells and not really a place where people lived, or you're going to see a lot of gas stations or stores. Across the street from the crash, there was a family who had two wells that required daily checks for workers. That family says that's why Jason's disappearance is so strange, that there's people out there every day, and nobody has ever seen any sign of Jason wandering into those fields or alongside the road, besides of the things that we've already mentioned?
As locals noted, after taking off his clothes, he would have been walking on some really rough terrain. It was hilly. It was wooded. There were areas with fences that were barbed wire. There were steep gullies and then creeks, and all of this covered in old electrical equipment and rusted oil pumps from those oil wells. Later that day is when Jason is officially declared missing. Texas Search and Rescue, which is a nonprofit group, came on to help lead the search team. Kent said law enforcement did not seem to care about where Jason was once they found marijuana in his backpack. So to him and his family, it just seems like from the very get-go, police were not diligent in any way trying to be helpful in finding his son. He said, quote, regardless of whether Jason was drunk, stoned, or any of the above, you had what you thought was a naked college student wandering in a place that he did not know in freezing cold weather with Arctic winds. You need to find that person and save them from themselves. However they got in that situation, find them and help them, end quote. I completely agree. This is a, you know, whether he's a criminal, whether he's, you know, just a drunk person, you've got to find this guy and get him some help.
You and I talked on the Patreon episode quite a bit about in the middle of a long conversation about missing persons, of some people want to disappear. And for that, police generally don't do anything. If it seems to be the case, that's true. But for somebody that you know is naked, you know is wandering, that's, I mean, he's not doing this on purpose, at least not in the right state of mind.
Yeah, absolutely. 2 days into the search, people were focusing on a small pond about 1,000 yards near the crash site. 8 different cadaver dogs signaled that there might be human remains in the water, but of course, nothing has been found.
Yeah, they used a sonar device to try to find something in the pond. They did find something they thought may be relevant, and they sent a dive team in. So they're going all out to try to find him and using a lot of resources around this pond, but there was no sign of Jason. A drone later spotted some objects that they thought may be related to a human, turned it out to be turtles. Eventually, search teams would drain the entire pond for 3 days, and once it had all the water out, it was still kind of a muddy pit, they were able to confirm that there was no sign of Jason in this pond. However, dogs continued to indicate interest in other bodies of water in the area. Several more were drained, several more were searched, and still no Jason. Over time, searchers started to think that maybe there was a chemical phenomenon in the area causing the dogs to hit. Maybe it had something to do with the oil production process, but obviously these are dogs that are trained, have shown themselves to be accurate, but they're hitting on like every body of water in the area, which I think probably deserves more study just in case situations like this happen moving forward. But for better or worse, they ended up searching all these ponds and found nothing. In retrospect, that may have been some time that could have been effectively used another way.
After 9 days, the Texas Search and Rescue announced that they were going to suspend their search efforts. By February of 2021, after Jason was missing for 2 months, outsiders were picking up the story and being drawn into Jason's case. People were sharing details and theories all over social media. That same month, Texas Search and Rescue started another 3-day hunt with over 100 volunteers, and they were hoping to cover more than 31,000 acres on foot. That is a lot. That is insane. There were search dogs, there were scouts on horseback, there were drones, there were water searches being conducted, and a helicopter survey. They gave all search data to the Caldwell County Sheriff's Office, who eventually admitted that when officers left the scene that night, they lost a crucial and critical period for searching for Jason.
Yeah, in retrospect, this is a really bad look on that police department to not do any kind of follow-up, to not initiate a search immediately when somebody's in danger. Obviously, this is a complex situation with a lot of different moving parts, but they still should have done something. He may have had a head injury, which we've discussed before. He may have also been high and injured his head. He had been researching lots of psychedelics. We have no indication that he had taken any that night, but of course it's got to be on the table. And then there's the potential mental impairment that makes it difficult for rescuers to get inside of his head. Because, you know, a lot of a search will say, well, normally when people are in a terrain like this, they tend to go toward water. They tend to walk toward a cliff and accidentally meet a ledge. They tend to do this or that. But if somebody is impaired, whether that is by mental illness or by an injury or by drugs, it's really hard to get in their head. There was also a big meteor shower that night, which may seem like it's not a big deal. But one field operator would say that imagine if he hit his head and he was in an altered state of mind and then he steps out of the car and it literally looks like the sky is falling. So maybe it wasn't a big deal for impairing the actual search, but if he was looking into all these other things about psychedelics and DMT, and if he's already high and hits his head and he looks up and sees all kinds of things flying through the sky, that's going to, I think, further impact his mental state. Criminologist Kim Rosmo was invited by the Caldwell County Sheriff to assist in their search efforts. Rosmo was known for creating the algorithm that can calculate the probable location of an offender's residence, which has led to the technique known as geographic profiling, which they've used that to find serial rapists, arsonists, and murderers really all around the world. In this situation, they're trying to apply those same principles to a missing person.
Rosmo created a geographic profile of the area where Jason went missing. He looked at the crash site data, and he went there in the daytime and at nighttime. One of the first things he did was try to recreate Jason's steps by taking off his shoes and walking down the gravel road barefoot at midnight. Dude, I love this approach. Trying to put yourself literally, I guess not in the shoes of someone, but where their shoes should be. And he said that he made it 10 steps before he finally had to say, F this, this is too painful.
That's a direct quote, by the way.
Yeah. As Rosmo stood at a nearby bridge one night, a truck came and stopped right next to him. He claims that when he approached the truck, the driver had a shotgun pointed at his chest. Rosmo antagonized the driver to the point where both men called the police. When Rosmo talked to Detective Jeff Ferry, he was told that the driver with the gun was landowner Stuart Carter. Ferry also said that Carter was known in town for two things: shooting two dogs who belonged to an oil worker, checking a well on his property, and shooting his own son during a family dispute. Carter insisted that those incidents were both done lawfully. There was a reporter who spoke with Carter, and Carter said that he was not holding a gun and that Rosmo was drunk and combative to one of Carter's female relatives just before their encounter. Rosmo denies this claim altogether. Nevertheless, Rosmo theorized if Jason was running through the area naked and disoriented, it's likely that Carter could have shot him if Carter saw him. Carter denies this, but when the reporter asked him what he thought might have happened if a naked person had wandered onto someone's property in this rural area of Caldwell County late at night, Carter said if it was a woman, people would probably think that she was in distress. If it was a naked man, I think it's safe to say that he could wind up dead.
That sounds like a very cold quote, but being from where I'm from, John, I can say that that would probably be the same interpretation many people would have in the rural area that I grew up in. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be that would not be a good situation for either party.
And I mean, come on, this is a really rural place, but this is also kind of far-fetched. They had nothing to prove that Carter had anything to do with it. Even the situation where Rosmo confronted him was kind of off kilter and hard to track what really happened. So yes, I think it's possible that somebody would have shot him if he was running around naked. But I think to put the focus on Carter was really narrow-minded of Rosmo. And Eventually, he moved on to a different theory. He completed his geographic profile, and he concluded that Jason most likely died from hypothermia. He figured after wrecking his car, Jason entered a dangerously hypothermic state running around naked. He claims that Jason probably gathered his belongings and tried to walk back toward town. That's when he started taking off his clothes during what's called paradoxical undressing, which is a common thing that people do when your blood vessels lose their ability to constrict. It allows a hypothermic body to keep warm near its core and away from its extremities. But the body can hold that for only so long before the blood rushes back to the arms and legs, and that makes the victims feel unbearably hot and like they need to take their clothes off. So this is a weird phenomenon that happens to people that get too cold and is very common and could be what happened with Jason. This is often followed by another phenomenon called terminal burrowing, where is a behavior that scientists think goes back to primitive times, where animals seek out a small enclosed space to shield them from the cold. Now, Rosmo theorizes that Jason took off his clothes and was compelled to burrow somewhere, maybe under a fallen tree or in some shrubbery, and then maybe he succumbed to the conditions there, to the elements, and was eventually eaten by animals like bobcats, vultures, and wild hogs in the area, and then any leftover remains would be spread over this gigantic area and unlikely to be identified. So basically, this theory is that he became hypothermic, which caused several negative reactions that ultimately led to him freezing to death and being devoured by animals.
There was a lot of people who questioned this theory. The night that he disappeared, the temperature was above freezing. It was somewhere between 36 and 43 degrees with a slight wind chill. Now, that is cold. Earlier we said it was freezing. We're in Texas. Texas doesn't get cold like this, except for, you know, at night, but this is unusually cold. I know when I visit family in Texas, I mean, we're talking about spending Christmas Day outside in shorts and a t-shirt because it's in the 70s and 80s. So for it to get 36 degrees outside, Texans feel like that is basically what Canadians feel like, right?
And here's the thing, Texas, I don't know if people understand that Texas is gigantic. It almost, if you go horizontally on a map, is almost half of our country. So there are parts that do get colder, but in this particular part, this was very cold for where he was, and there was a cold front, but that doesn't mean it was a blizzard.
Something else, a phenomenon, I don't have a name for this. I'm inventing it myself, all right? But do you know, like, if it's summertime and the weather drops down and one night something weird happens and it's in the 50s, that feels absolutely frigid.
Right.
But right now, in the time of year we're recording, if it hits 50 degrees, it's like shorts weather.
Yeah.
It feels great.
It's all relative.
Your body adjusts to and, you know, finds the outliers as uncomfortable one way or the other. There's also the time between Jason's last communication and when his car was found. This is just a little more than an hour. Is it possible, really, that hyperthermia could set in by, you know, in these temperatures in that short amount of time? I don't think so. Personally, I don't.
Very doubtful.
But in July 2021, Rosmo turned his findings and theory over to Caldwell County Sheriff's Office, which they latched onto. But the wild animal theory is also disputed by local landowners. One reason they say that this probably isn't true is that during the days Jason was missing, no one noticed vultures in the sky circling or anything like that. And locals know that vultures hover above the dying livestock before they would swoop down to eat it. Nobody reported any vultures around the time Jason went missing. Plus, even vultures signal a dead body. The scavenging creatures don't wipe away all signs of a body. There would be remnants left. A longtime rancher in the area said that we've never heard of animals picking someone's body clean out and like getting rid of it. There's always something left.
And that quote tells us a lot of things. That tells us that, A, there have been bodies out there before, whether they're cattle or human. But these people have seen this. And Rosmo was brought in for this. I would trust locals to know more about the climate and things that usually happen than him. So I tend to agree with them on this one. Jason's case still remains alive. It's active. And a lot of investigators and web sleuths are looking into it, trying to figure out what happened to Jason. There are several Facebook pages out there and groups, some with about 50,000 members. One of those members is Jim West, who is a 55-year-old Houston software executive. And Jim is also the co-leader of a volunteer Jason Landry search team. He's spent a significant amount of his own money trying to help find Jason. He said, "It's as if a UFO came down, sucked him up into a beam of light, and flew away. The deeper you go, the stranger it gets." By February of 2022, the Texas Attorney General's Cold Case and Missing Persons Unit started helping out on the case at the request of the District Attorney and Sheriff's Offices of Caldwell County. The office has spent hundreds of hours on this case, interviewing dozens of witnesses. In November of 2023, the office hosted a roundtable case review involving multiple agencies and experts to try to come up with new ideas and theories. They concluded that all credible leads and investigative steps had been pursued. The roundtable did not believe Jason intended to meet with anyone in or around Lu Ling at that time, and there didn't appear to be any evidence of foul play. They consider the matter an ongoing and active investigation, but have no current big leads or theories that need to be explored.
To this day, Jason's parents don't believe the wild animal theory that the police continue to push. Kent said that Lu Ling is not the end of the world, and it's amazing to still think that you could be so close to so many people, and yet we still don't have answers in some ways. We have less answers, end quote. He thinks it's really unlikely that a wild hog would have been able to consume the entire corpse of, you know, his son, including all the bones, all before searchers arrived the next morning. And I completely agree with him. I don't think that that would be the case.
Can you imagine being a parent even having to think about this?
No, man. But you know, even you would see signs, you would see blood, you would see tissue. I mean, something would trigger, you know, you would know something had happened.
I agree.
There. Kent says the animal theory is a way for police to feel off the hook for this disappearance. The Office of the Attorney General continues to encourage anyone with any critical or credible information to contact the Missing Persons Unit, and we can leave a link to that website. Kent says that his son's case is a reminder of how important family is. He said, quote, "As a family of faith, we know that we'll see Jason again and that it may be a while, but I'll see him again in heaven," end quote. But Jason's family has not given up hope. Kent would go on to say, "Maybe one day at the right moment, the right person will be looking at a patch of ground and see something, and maybe that will be our answer." So yeah, my prayers go out to this family, and I pray that they could find out what happened to their son. I think, you know, Occam's razor is what the simplest solution is often what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he was already in an altered mental health state of some kind. And I think maybe he was injured in some way. And I think he's walked somewhere, and maybe he didn't die of hypothermia in just a couple of hours, but to what extent was he injured? You know, was he able to make it to a tree somewhere and not able to walk anywhere else? You know, I think maybe it's possible he's still somewhere where someone hasn't looked, and it's just a vast area out there.
And unfortunately, I don't think we're going to find him alive at this point. I mean, if there's any theory about somebody picking him up, I think picking up a naked guy on the highway would be something that people would report. I mean, unless they're malicious and did something with him or to him, which, again, there's no evidence of that. So
I think if we had known, or if the police dogs could have got there sooner and left the car at the scene, maybe there was a dog that could pick up a track or a trail. You know, you let the dog sniff the car and then mm-hmm. you follow the trail. it's just really unfortunate that none of that happened.
It is, and we can't go back and do that. I do hope that this family gets some answers. I mean, there's always that little bit of hope, but I am not confident at all that we're going to find Jason living. Just really hope that those answers can come and that they'll find out not only where he is, but potentially what happened so that they can go to bed at night knowing what happened to their son. And again, just I'm glad they're in a place where they have some optimism about seeing Jason again. As a person of faith, I admire that type of faith as well, but yeah, just hope they get some answers, man. I think they can. I don't think this is out of the realm of possibility. I think this is one of those that will be solved someday or will be answered someday. It's just a matter of when and how much we learn.
It also sucks that he didn't hold on to his cell phone, because maybe that could have been, you know, helpful. But,
right.
But anyway, yeah, I think you're right. I think we'll find an answer soon, or, you know, someday. Maybe not soon, but someday.
Yeah.
Jamie, this was a good one, man. Prayers for this family, but yeah, that's going to do it for this one.
Yep. We appreciate you guys hanging out with us. Again, we'll put links in case you happen to live in Texas or happen to know somebody around that area or happen to be an expert in a field that could help answer these questions. So we'll put that link out there. Otherwise, we'd love to hear more reviews come in on Apple Podcasts or over on Spotify, even on social media. Facebook's a great place to leave reviews. And we would love to hear from you all there. Also a great way to make case recommendations.
Don't forget, yesterday we released a brand new episode that's only available on patreon.com. Go check out The Suitcase Murder.
Yep, really good case. And we'll be back next week with another one.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.